Hello and welcome to the Global Trading Podcast. I'm Terry Flanagan, editor of Global Trading. Global Trading is a markets media group publication. Today we are speaking about private equity, specifically InvestX. InvestX is a leading private equity marketplace that empowers broker-dealers to invest in pre-IPO companies through single-user special purpose vehicles, or SPVs, multi-issuer funds, and secondary market trading. Pleased to be joined today on the podcast by Marcus New. Marcus is founder and CEO at InvestX. Marcus, great to have you. Thanks for coming on the Global Trading Podcast.
Hey, great to be here, Terry.
Okay, let's jump right in. Let's kind of take it back a ways. Can you briefly discuss your own career background and how and why InvestX came to be and was launched in 2014, so almost 10 years ago now?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So in the early 90s, I got a business degree from Trinity Western University, and I loved the stock market. I'd been an entrepreneur. I had done a number of things during high school, during university, but I was really interested in the stock market. And so I ended up working for an analyst in 1994, just after graduating from university, covering small cap stocks in the public equity markets. And as a result of that, being entrepreneurial and seeing this thing called the internet, at the time back in 1994 was really, a blank screen on a computer. And computers were pretty nascent back then too. But we launched a company called Stock Group in 1995, which really was a fintech company. We call it ASP, we call it a SaaS business today, where we delivered portfolio tools and stock market data to brokerage firms, hedge funds, and different media companies. And so we were this back office for the delivery of, these different applications and market data that eventually was used by the customers of the bank or the brokerage firm or the hedge fund. And so we started to cover the markets as well because we had our own financial community. And then in early 2000, we bought a company called Stockhouse, which was a very large financial community that covered the public equity markets. So we had this SaaS business where we private labeled tools to the financial tools and data to the brokerage industry. And then we had our own media business where we basically provided that content directly to, and those tools directly to investors. And there was about 1 million investors that would go there a month. And the idea was, as we built those businesses, was to really provide access to investors to information. Because the problem back in the 90s was the brokerage industry controlled data and information. So if you wanted to know what was going on in the security that you invested in, you really had to pay very, very high fees, like 3.25%, 3.5% to trade. Then the market makers would take another 1/8 or 1/16, because the market maker world back then. And so there's a heavy amount of fees that existed in that market. And so with companies like us and Stockhouse and other companies like Yahoo Finance, E-Trade, and this kind of convergence of the discount brokers with the information providers online, all of a sudden reduced fees dramatically and increased market participation in a dramatic way. And so we now have more and more people now using the markets and investing because they could get access to information and they could lower their cost of trading. And so as we covered those markets for a number of years, eventually ended up selling the data business to a company out of Chicago. And then eventually I sold the media business to a company out of Australia. So, but what we learned was, as we saw coming into kind of 2010s, this is post kind of the big, market correction and recession of 2009, was that private companies that were backed by venture capital, so they're really the leading IPOs in the world, were starting to stay private longer. And sometimes you have to uniquely be in an industry to really see some of these details in a really intimate way. And so Facebook was a good example. Facebook went public at $104 billion in valuation. So $104 billion of value is created in the private markets. Whereas you looked at Amazon, it went public at $442 million. And so you saw this major discrepancy on where value is created. For Amazon, all the value is created in the public equity markets to public equity shareholders, which are the pension funds and individual retail and, and all the various different market participants. But when you looked at Facebook, it was quite different. Over $100 billion of value was accreted, generated by the employees and early shareholders. And so when we started to look at that industry more closely, what was happening, the change in the IPO market, US IPO market, really, we saw that, there was about 10 or 12 institutional investors that were the investors every single time that were investing. It was almost like this club of institutional investors that would basically get access to these late stage rounds. They would invest in these companies, 3, 4, 5 years before they go public, and they would generate all the returns. And these companies were Fidelity and Wellington and TPG, and eventually Tiger Global when they started to come in other hedge fund and started to invest a lot more. But we thought, like, this is fundamentally unfair. There has to be a way, you know, that broader group of people can get access to this amazing asset class. Because one of the big challenges in the industry was these leading companies usually were number one in the world in their space, right? You look at Facebook, it was number one in the world as an example. And so they would really traditionally only get banked when they went to IPO by two firms. One was Goldman Sachs, the other one was Morgan Stanley. And so Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs controlled the IPO market, you know, for those companies. And so if you were a regular investor, there's no way you could get access to the IPO shares. It just would never happen. And so you couldn't get access to the IPO shares. You couldn't get access to the rounds prior to it. And so we really started Vestex with the idea of how can we create broader access, very similar to what we did in the 90s with Stock Group and with Stockhouse in terms of how do we help investors get access to information to be able to be more successful investors. In 2014, 2015, when we started the business, it was really about how do we get access to this asset class for a broader group of people. And so that really is what kind of started off in Vestex way back when, you know, almost 10 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. And what has been the growth of Investec since its launch? Can you share some milestones and highlights and give some indication of the size of the firm today?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when we first started the firm back in 2014, as I mentioned, the goal was basically to provide access to this asset class. And so, you know, but it was really easy to think about that. How could I get access to these companies, make them available to other investors, and then obviously, you know, hopefully have really successful outcomes? But in reality, it became very, very challenging, very, very difficult because there's a number of really significant constraints in the private markets that just don't exist in the public equity markets. For example, how do you get access to information on these companies? You know, so in the public equity markets, there's requirements like 8Ks and news releases and quarterly financials. And so all the information is available to everyone. Now, arguably, Goldman Sachs computers can analyze and look at that information faster than a human can. But putting aside that small difference, you know, the reality is it's readily available. When you look at the private market, so it's almost the exact opposite. It's not available to anyone. Private companies don't want to disclose information, don't want people to have it because it's competitive trade secrets for them. They want to know the performance of that business, keep it to only very few people. And so if you're an institutional asset manager like we are, it's very, very difficult to invest in something unless you can basically underwrite it or do the due diligence on it. And so getting access to information was really, really challenging and really difficult. The second piece that was really challenging about the industry was if you could get access to information and you could decide what you wanted to pay, how do you find shares to buy? Those companies typically only raise money about every 20 months. So basically, if you think about that, there's an entry point almost every 2 years where you may be able to purchase them in their primary. And primary means when they're issuing shares to raise capital for the firm. And so finding shares was an issue. And the second part of how you could access shares would be what we call secondary. And secondary means where an early shareholder would want to sell shares to basically make their profits. Or it could be early employees exercising their stock options, or institutional investors, seed shareholders, et cetera. So the secondary market is also really interesting because there are people that want to sell shares really at any given time in any of these companies. Because if you think about it, these companies are really the winners. Usually they're number one in the world in their space. They're just private. So people want to get access to liquidity or block in their profits. But how do you find them? You know, just because someone wants to sell doesn't mean you can find it. There was no place to go, you know, an exchange to go to where you could find these people. And then if you did find someone that wanted to sell their shares, how do you determine price? Because there's no price discovery. So the market, where there's no transparency in the market, it had a lot of kind of barriers in order to be successful in it. And so here you had this very, very difficult challenge, right? Which is, you know, you could see the prize. The prize was, you know, these club institutional investors were making a lot of great returns by investing in these companies 2 to 3 or 4 years before they go public. They were there on their own. They would get access to the growth of that company, where most of that company had been de-risked from a business perspective because these were now late stage companies prior to them going public. But when you wanted to invest or we wanted to invest, we'd have to find information, we'd have to find shares, we'd have to understand price, and then we'd have to deal with the illiquidity of the asset class overall. And so these were the big constraints in the industry. And what we spent our time doing was really figuring out how to solve for those problems. And so, you know, in our early days, some of our initial milestones was actually investing in just some amazing businesses. You know, we were early, we got access to amazing companies like Spotify that we invested in 2 or 3 years before it went public, DocuSign, which we invested in 2 to 3 years before it went public, you know, Dropbox, Pinterest, a number of other great, amazing businesses, Uber, Lyft, before they went public. So this was terrific. And But as we grew our business, and most of our business is done through broker dealers, and so we distribute through the broker dealer, the wealth channel, we found that, you know, it was just difficult to do this business in a scalable way because of all these constraints. And so one of the things that we found the industry problem was, how, when we wanted to buy a block of shares as an institution, you know, how could we find those shares? And so we built what we call GEM. So GEM is our growth equity marketplace. So GEM is an institutional platform only. So it's not available for retail investors. It's only available for broker dealers. It's registered with the SEC. It's what they call an ATS, an alternative trading system. And what we tried to do with GEM was to basically create a venue where institutional venues could meet. Think of it like a trading post, an institutional trading post for block trades or lending in the public equity markets, where institutions could meet and basically negotiate price and be able to find some price discovery and find the other side of a trade for large blocks. So for example, if Fidelity wanted to sell $30 million of Klarna, you know, it could be represented by Goldman Sachs or by Citigroup, you know, and you could have Tiger Global being represented on the buy side, you know, by Jefferies, and they could meet up at our venue to be able to facilitate a transaction between them that would allow them to be able to get liquidity and to purchase the shares at the price they want to pay, you know. Mm-hmm. And those blocks typically are 30 million, 50 million, 20 million, 100 million, things like that. It's not retail. So by building that platform, what it allowed us to do was to help our partners, because our goal is to help our broker dealer partners to be able to get access to this asset class, you know, from a fundamental managed approach, which we do with our investment manager. So we provide funds that are available to their clients, which would be usually 15 to 20 position funds. And then we provide single purpose vehicles that you mentioned earlier, where they could buy a single investment. So they could buy a diversified fund where they could allocate capital to it in their portfolio to get access to this asset class, or they could purchase single investments that might fit their investment strategy in a different way. And then on the institutional side, helping our partners to be able to work with their institutional clients to be able to also create liquidity and be able to be more successful at accessing and getting price transparency in this market. And so really serving up and down our partners, being the brokerage firms, you know, they're different kind of clients within that firm, was really our goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we built that, we work with, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens, you know, of broker dealers, helping them with this. We have more than 4,000 limited partners now through our broker dealer clients that now can get access to this amazing asset class. And we've been, you know, continuing to build our business in a really successful way. And so, which we've been really proud of in terms of creating very consistent returns through our portfolios and through our single investments, as well as creating the ability for institutional clients to get access to, you know, price discovery and finding the other side of a match on a trade, which is also really, really important for them.
Right. Now, if we were to look a little more into, you know, InvestX's goal of aiming to democratize pre-IPO private equity, talked about this a fair amount so far in terms of how InvestX does this, but you had mentioned earlier, I think that said 10 or 12 institutional firms used to be the concentrated investors in private equity. But how has InvestX and how have the times expanded to broaden the universe? I mean, are there high net worth individuals involved in this asset class? Is it family offices, hedge funds, and do the, you know, retail mom and pop have any opportunity at this time to be involved in pre-IPO private equity?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really started off, and let's define the asset class that we invest in, because private equity can be really multi different kind of facets to it. So private equity historically been known as controlled buyouts, where a fund would come in, buy 50+% of the company, usually 80, 20% would stay with management. They would use leverage or debt in order to basically help increase returns. And that's what they would do. They would help create more performance in that business and then sell it using that debt as a lower rate than what the growth rate is, and they would make a profit. And so there's lots of different types of private equity. There's infrastructure where you might buy an airport or bridge. You know, there's venture capital where you would take risk, where you invest in early stage companies. There'd be lots of zeros. You're looking for a home run with one company in your portfolio to make the returns. And then there's what we call late stage venture or growth equity or late stage private equity or pre-IPO. They're all really the same words for this stage that we invest in. The stage that we invest in is basically we invest in the winners out of venture, you know, with the goal of owning them 2 to 3 years or up to 4 years, although we've had some at 5, but, you know, before they go public or before they have a trade sale. And trade sale would be like a strategic acquisition, for example. And so the goal here is for us is to own those companies. Why do we want to own that company versus own something else in the private equity landscape? Well, what we really find attractive about growth equity is that there's really no zeros, right? You know, the venture take a lot of zeros. Now, we definitely can take losses. There's no question. But what we're really looking for and the risks that we're managing are very different risks. I mean, these are really mid-sized technology companies in most cases, right? And by mid-sized being U.S. mid-sized, if you looked at Canada, for example, it would be like large cap technology in Canada. But the idea basically is that we take growth rate risk. Will they continue to grow at the speed that they're growing at today? And we take valuation risk. Are we buying at the right valuation? You know, we always take overall execution risk. But the reality is those are the main risks that we're looking at in terms of investing here. Because now there's no 10Xs where we invest because we're not taking that level of risk. But the goal for us is to generate a 2X cash on cash return as a base case and a 3 as a target case. You know, when we do these investing. And so we like the inefficiencies of the private markets that help drive a bunch of the returns, you know, versus, you know, taking like a venture risk or taking a controlled buyout. So that's the space where we are. And so historically getting those late stage rounds, those would be what you'd call series C, D, E, F in, you know, kind of venture world language. It historically had been those club institutional investors. And then we came in and some others came in. And so now there's, you know, there's a few funds that invest dedicated in this specific asset class and area. It is very hard to do, right? You know, compared to if you look at private equity, for example, you know, in private equity, they get data rooms. There's an auction process to see who can basically buy the company for the most amount of money. But the information is very transparent. Everyone has it that's trying to buy. Everyone looks at it and they make good decisions based on the data that's there, right? In the growth equity space, information is very asymmetrical, meaning very few people have it. And those who have it have a huge competitive advantage. And we use that obviously as an important part of how we invest and how we create returns by having access to information. So, but the market has really expanded. I would say that when the public equity markets were roaring in 2021, you know, the height of the bull market, you know, every family office and high net individual wanted to be here. And why did they want to be here? Because the returns were substantive. Not only were they substantive, but they could never get access to IPO shares because going back to what we said earlier, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley really control that market. I saw a study just a couple of years ago, but it was something like 92 or 93% of the leading tech IPOs were done by Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. So if you were not, you know, a high institutional client there, you were never getting access to those IPO shares. And so what people recognize is, well, we better go in the private markets and get access to them there. So we get a chance of getting them, not only to get the returns there. So there's really kind of an expansion of interest from that point because you saw family offices and high net worths. And this is where you saw in our business too. We grew to 4,000 limited partners investing because of they want to get access to this really incredible asset class. So, but it is accredited product only, which means that you have to have financial assets over $1 million. In many cases, for a lot of our partner broker dealer firms, it's really qualified purchasers only. So sometimes it's only $5 million you have to have in assets. But we are getting a broader group of people that can access it today versus certainly 10 years ago, whereas institutional only.
Right. Okay. Okay, Marcus, a few more questions I have. If we were to look at the trading experience, specifically, say the trading private equity, how does this compare? And this may be apples, oranges type question. How does it compare with trading, say, listed equities on a public exchange in terms of efficiency, friction, bid-ask spreads, things like, you know, brass tacks of the actual trading?
Yeah, I would compare that to basically looking at a Ferrari and comparing that to a Neanderthal man who needed, who could barely walk. And so, and maybe that's not the right comparison using the Neanderthal man, but the construct of it is that, you know, there's really no trading in private equity, right? So if you think about trade today, you could be on the bid and offer and you could execute a trade on both sides and get out of a trade in 1 second. In the public equity markets, in the private markets, there's a whole bunch of restrictions and constraints again. So really, it's more just about investing versus trading, right? It's, you know, trying to find the other side of your trade is really trying to find the other side of your investment. Either you're selling it, so we could call that trading. But when you use the word trading in the public equity markets, most of us would think of that in maybe a different way. And so, you know, really, like I said, there really is no comparison. I think that the big piece is that you know, it's hard to find the other side of a trade in the private markets. It's hard to find price discovery. And then there's one big issue in the private markets that will never let you really trade securities, you know, which is that you know, you have to go through, if you want to be on the cap table of the company, you have to go through about a 30-day process with the company where they go through ROFR and shareholder agreement and things like that. And so it's very, very difficult, for example, where you see some inefficiency. And we've seen this, for example, where in a given week, a specific security will trade a 20% difference in price. That would never happen in any market, but it happens in the private markets where, you know, someone might have bought it at $20 and someone bought it at $25 the same week because they had no idea what the other price was or what the, you know, trading was at. You know, go back to use the word trading. So there's not a lot of comparison. But what I would say is that, you know, we're working on ways to solve for that, you know, where investors that have purchased, you know, maybe smaller amounts of securities, you know, can trade that to another investor without having to go through the cap table, which makes it a lot easier for the issuers, but also create more liquidity for them. And so we've been experimenting with the ability for, you know, kind of small shareholders to trade amongst themselves or to be able to sell. It's more to sell and buy. Because when you buy a private security, you're not looking to sell it the next day. You're looking to own that company, right? And so most right. people buy it to hold it in the private markets.
Right. So it sounds like trading pre-IPO private equity is more akin to, say, buying or selling art or real estate than listed equities on a public exchange.
That's probably a great example. I mean, because you may want to, you know, change your home after 2 or 3 years or change that piece of art after 2 or 3 years, right? And then that could happen in the private markets, for example. But you typically wouldn't want to go into your home and the next month sell it, right? So that's probably right. a great example, actually, of how it's similar.
Okay. You mentioned earlier some of the success stories of the growth names which have appeared on your platform. Any more success stories to share or elaboration on that? And also, what are the most actively traded equities on InvestX currently?
Yeah. So, I mean, really comes down to what's our process, our investment process, which is what drives the results of being able to invest in these incredible companies. And one of the things I love about the business is that, you know, not only do we invest in the world's greatest companies, but we also invest in some of the world's greatest leadership teams and management teams. So, but it really starts off with our investment team. So our investment team looks at about 100 companies a year. You know, we go through a kind of a process of screening them, and we have a number of criteria that we're looking for. You know, the average company we invest in is about $3.5 billion. You know, we look for companies that are growing 30 to 40% a year. Why does that matter? Because in the public equity markets, they're growing around 10, right? So we've got a 3x growth rate, which mm-hmm. obviously helps in returns. If you think about vectors and how to make money, you know, one vector is I'm investing in something that's growing substantially faster than the public comps. The second is I'm getting a liquidity discount, meaning because they're private, I get a discount to the public comps. So I get to get that vector of return, right? So, and then typically there's other vectors that we kind of focus on. But so we look at this process where we look at about 100 companies and we find about 6 to 12 companies that we can invest in a year or want to invest in a year. And then the reality is we only probably find about 6 to 8 companies that we can actually buy at the price we want to buy. You know, we love a company called Stripe, for example. It's just been very, very difficult to find it in the price range of what we want to pay where we think that we can make really predictable returns on it. But that is a world-class company with world-class management, with incredible defensive competitive moats, right? But right now in the secondary market, it's too expensive for us. And so those are the kind of things where we can find companies we really want to own, but that doesn't necessarily mean we can buy them at the prices that we need to buy them at so that we can create consistent returns. So that's really kind of what we do. You know, we do, as you mentioned earlier, we use funds. You know, our funds are 5 years only, and we use single investments where, you know, investors can choose a specific company. So some of the great companies, I've mentioned them before, that we've been involved with, you know, the DocuSigns, the Spotify's. You know, there's also some maybe not as well-known companies that I think are tremendous investments that we've made, like Cross River Bank. It's an infrastructure for much of the banking for, you know, online financial companies. You know, we made a recent investment in OpenAI, an amazing generational, I think it'll be a generational company. I'm probably one of the most important companies in the world today is that company. You know, SpaceX, another example. You know, many fintech companies. And then there's some alternatives that we've made some investments in, like an Impossible Foods that's trying to change how, you know, meat is delivered, or the, you know, a byproduct of meat. Well, it's not even a byproduct, but you know what I mean. So those are the kind of things. Usually what's most active and interest is usually what the big brands are. So you think about a SpaceX or an OpenAI, those kind of things. The big industries right now that are have the most amount of flow into it are, you know, AI for 100%, space, health tech. These are big areas that there's a lot of demand for and flow into. You know, but I like buying things, and we like buying things at InvestX that are out of favor where there's deep discounts. You know, we have a company that we're making investment right now that literally is a 70% discount to the public comps, an 84% discount to a $750 million round done last year that we were able to get in a structured kind of financing deal. And so there's some amazing businesses at some great discounts, because right now, the big challenge is if you want to sell your shares in the private markets today, there's virtually no buyers. The market is totally illiquid. And so in funds like us can go in and say, look, it's $100 for that those shares that you paid $500 for. And if you don't want to sell it, don't sell it. But if you do, it's $100. And, you know, and we're finding that some people are desperate. They need to sell it because they need liquidity, and we're buying it for $100. And so we're getting some really amazing value right now in the markets. But when the IPO market opens up, that usually goes away because more and more participants come back to the market because they want to get access to it before the IPOs.
And Marcus, as my final question, if we could just spin this conversation forward a bit, what is the future of InvestX, say both near-term 2024 initiatives or plans, and further out, what is the longer-term vision?
Yeah, I mean, we want to be exceptional partners to our broker-dealer partners. We want to serve them in an exceptional way of being able to bring them access to the best quality companies in this area and asset class. We want to help them with their institutional clients and being able to match the other side of trades. You know, we really want to be a very, very important piece of infrastructure for these firms. So that's really our goal. You know, the second piece of that is we want to deliver, obviously, very consistent returns to those clients, right? And so making sure that we've got very good analysis, we've got a really good deep investment team that can look at companies really deeply, make sure that we're investing in some of the most important companies, but at the right price that can create the best returns for clients in a very, very consistent way. And then I think the third piece is that, you know, we love our issuers, you know, our investment partners. By investment partners, I mean the companies we invest in. You know, we usually work with the management teams there to be able to help them with some of their odd lots that they have. You know, odd lots are where employees or early shareholders need to sell. There's not as much institutional demand for small amounts like $800,000 or $2 million blocks. And we usually work with managers to help collect a lot of those and pick those up, which is a service for them. There's a number of other things that we like to do with, to help out our investment companies as well. So I think, you know, serving our partners at the broker deal level, creating consistent returns, and then helping our issuer partners or our investment partners at the company level are really our three kind of pillars of what we really focus on. And as a result of that, we continue to, you know, really create, again, a more healthier and larger successful business that creates, you know, better returns for more and more customers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. We've covered a lot of ground here. This has been a very interesting and informative discussion about the pre-IPO private equity trading marketplace and InvestX specifically. I want to thank once again our guest today, Marcus New, founder and CEO at InvestX. Marcus, thanks a lot for being on and sharing your insight in InvestX's story.
Great to be here. Thanks for your time.
I'm Terry Flanagan, editor at Global Trading. You can find the Global Trading podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's also on the Global Trading website, which is fixglobal.com.